I'm here in Temple Ogan and I'm talking to John Chadwick. John, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Templemore in County Tipperary.
What year?
I was born in 1921 and I was reared in Templemore until I joined the army at the age of 19.
That was quite a young age. Was it something that you always wanted to do, or was it something that your parents asked you to do?
Well, briefly, my parents died when I was an infant, and I was reared by bachelor uncle, Dr. Dennis Chadwick, Templemore. And he was extremely helpful to me and encouraged me in every respect. But it wasn't the same as someone else being saying, this is what I think you should do. I was waiting on the results of my leaving cert in 1940. And it was just at that time that they were recruiting heavily for the Defence Forces. Second World War had broken out in 1939. And while waiting on the results of my leaving cert, I joined the army without giving due notice to my guardian and my uncle. I was 19 years of age.
And at that stage, it must have been exciting for a young lad going into the army, because, you know, it was soldiering and it was, I suppose, the excitement of the Second World War. At the time, did you see it like that, or did you see it more seriously as a German army being a threat to this country?
I have to be absolutely honest. The fact that there was a war going on was incidental to the fact that I suddenly found myself in the army, and it was literally from the sublime to the ridiculous. It was tough at the bottom end, and recruits are coming in at the rate of 300 a day into Limerick, where I joined. But from there it became more interesting, because I was required to do a number of courses which eventually gave me the exalted rank of corporal. So on the square in Collins Barracks, Cork, I was seen to march fellows much bigger than myself, stature-wise. And they saw fit to put me forward for a commission. So in 1941, I was sent to the military college in the Curragh, where after, I think it was 9 months, a year, I was commissioned as second lieutenant in the Defence Forces.
Just describe to me the mood and the atmosphere in Curragh Camp at the time.
Well, it was a mix and gather in regard to the age bracket. In the officer rank, you had very few young cadets, because they had ceased commissioning cadets around that time, and people were being brought in from all walks of life. Professional, non-professional, people seeing the necessity of standing by the colours, etc. It was very mixed, and I would have been one of a number of quite young, relatively young, in the officer's mess.
So people joining, they didn't really need any qualifications of any kind, did they?
Not at that time. When it came to being put forward for commission, yes, a standard of education certainly was required, and proof of your ability to manage men, even in the small way you did as a non-commissioned officer.
The war itself, can you give me an idea as to what the threat was? Was it seriously looked at as being a threat at the time?
It was certainly taken seriously, and as one got older in the army, the training you were getting, it was obvious you were preparing for something much more than just marching up and down the square. But the events abroad were probably contained in any political statements, in as much as we were neutral. But the ironical thing was, whilst we were neutral, a number of the belligerent people at war, British, German, became our internees, so to speak, for the time being. In as much as planes were being shot down off the coast or landing in Irish territory, and as a result, you had both Luftwaffe and RAF in so-called internment camps in the Curra. In fact, it just meant that they were accepted, and they accepted the fact that they were belligerents, but not at war.
So they went off course, and they found themselves on Irish soil, and
yes,
they were captured and imprisoned. Or would you call it
well,
imprisonment?
Well, no, they were interned, I think would be the word.
Yes.
The distinction was some of our own nationals were also imprisoned or interned quite near them, some 400 or 500, some of whom I knew, I had gone to school with, and they were all in the Curra. Both the RAF and the Luftwaffe had permission to leave camp each day for a limited period. Some went forward and studied in universities or just stayed locally, but they were required to report back each evening.
That's interesting, and they all got on very well together, did they?
There are amusing things associated with it, in as much as I was secretary of the Curra Lawn Tennis Club, and in due course, the enthusiast from either of the belligerents asked if they could join, and they were permitted. But it was a question of making sure that you didn't rock the boat when it came to whose turn was it next. Another amusing part of it was the little cinema, the local cinema, had a very limited space to contain the bodies. And officers, seeing that in the Curra, everything was military, whether it was a shop or whether it was a cinema or the church, it was all built around military people. And as a result, if a film was being shown, and if by coincidence that particular time the British or the Germans were winning, and something was shown on the screen, there was uproar and absolute delight and caps thrown in the air and so on to celebrate the local victory.
And when the tennis was going on, did you have, I mean, were there games, you know, were the Germans playing tennis against the English, or were they?
No, under no circumstances. They had found ladies who could play from the game or play with between themselves. And a number of them married locally.
And these would have been local women from
yes,
from
or
Kildare, or
they
from...
might have met them in Dublin, or because some of them were attending university.
I see. And you know, the Republican prisoners that are internees at that time, you said there were numbering 400 to 500.
The actual number I couldn't tell you.
But they were members of the Republican Army from all parts of the country, and we call them the old IRA, I suppose.
There were the government, or the at the time felt that that's where they should be rather than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. Our job was to ensure that they remained in there, and there was never any serious incident as far as I was concerned. But I did duty, as one was required from time to time, on guard. Where each day there was a guard put on duty, and it was an officer in charge, and that would be a duty that might come up maybe once or twice a year.
What about the actual weaponry? Were the soldiers in the camp well equipped at the time?
equipped as far as it was possible to from the Department of Defense to secure up-to-date equipment. In my case, I was with the corps known as cavalry, which, as the name suggests, is to do with horses and all that. But in fact, the modern cavalry is mechanized, and I was involved with armored cars and subsequently tanks. And that was, we were as well equipped as we could have been. The armored cars were built locally using conventional guns such as Vickers as their armament. And latterly, we got some tanks in the British War Office, and I was involved very much with that when they arrived. But as far as infantry and artillery were concerned, artillery were pretty well equipped. Infantry had the basics, such as the Enfield rifle and the Bren gun, the Vickers gun, and I've forgotten the other one. A more recent one.
But were these the arsenal of weaponry, was it sufficient for an Irish army at the time?
It would only have been sufficient for the immediate standoff, if you like, because the strategist, I reckon, had decided more or less where an invasion might take place. And I can only speak as a junior officer. We would have been required to put up a local defence, so to speak. The corps I was with were entirely involved with what we call reconnaissance, which is a more a movement operation than an infantry or artillery.
And that was for moving troops around the coastline, was it, or?
Well, no. Cavalry are armed. They're moving with guns. In other words, armored cars are equipped with guns. They are fighting and moving. Transport per se for troops would be supplied by the Transport Corps, which are purely lorries and backup vehicles for supplies, ammunition, and food and that.
Where did the LDF fit in the overall picture? Can you describe to me the difference between being a member or being a soldier in the Irish Army and being part of the LDF?
Well, the LDF, as it was originally called, became the FCA. The boats remained mobilized for a while. Then eventually the FCA took over the entire role. They were voluntary in every sense of the word. They were doing pretty well the same type of duty as the Reserve Garda Force do today. They were unpaid, and as such, they were, as the name suggests, they were local. They would have known the locality. They were trained to a good standard infantry training, basically, and they were equipped from local arsenal.
And could you tell me now as well, were there deserters from the Irish Army who wanted more action and travelled to the north of Ireland to join the British forces in the north? People who genuinely wanted to get into the war, I suppose.
Well, the answer is yes. They were deserted. They certainly weren't encouraged, and they were frowned on very much. And I think a lot of what you just said is it was the attraction of the action, some of whom saw quite a lot of action, because one or two deserted from my own unit. But conversely, we did have people who came from the other side and had come back having joined the British Army, and were very welcome as recruits in our army,
In the Irish Army,
already
yeah.
trained.
Yes, of course they were. Yes, at the time. What were the training standards like? Was it relaxed, or was it very strenuous,
It was strict,
the
very strict.
regime?
the street. There were training depots, such as Cork, Dublin's one. The command training depot in Cork was the one that I was sent to shortly after I joined, and I spent quite a lot of my early career in Cork. And we were involved in the basic things of foot drill, arms drill, and then the use of arms. The discipline was absolutely strict. What more can I say other than that the numbers were huge when you compare it. It was from a standing start, where these barracks like in the Curra or in Cork or in Tralee for that matter, were literally, they were empty. There was just a nucleus of an army. And it suddenly burst out in my time, around to become 40,000, almost from zero.
Yeah, imagine that. And the code of conduct, was that strict
yes.
in itself too?
Well, you didn't stand idly by. As far as discipline was concerned, it was ultimate. And is in every army, it's essential. And the commanding officer would have local powers if I found people were digressing. There is military law as distinct from the civil law. And we worked to that.
Your time spent in the army, did you enjoy those days?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. If I have any regret to the day I die, is that I left the army midstream. I left when I was 40 years of age. I had been a captain for 12 years, I think, and I didn't see the immediate prospect of promotion. And a number of my colleagues had left and appeared to find that their army training was helping them towards doing things with more remuneration, shall we say.
Would it have helped, finding a career after the army if you had army experience behind you?
Was it?
Going forward, into another job.
What's the question, sorry?
Did you find it easy getting into another position, having the army background to your
I lived on the presumption that it would be very simple. It was a very, very abrupt awakening, inasmuch as I was involved in the sale of heavy equipment, the building equipment, construction equipment. And the fact that I had a good knowledge of how machines worked, I had no knowledge or experience of selling, and that's what I was required to do. And I had to cover 26 counties of Ireland to do that. But with the help of the acceptance of my managers, I got to grips with it, and eventually became the person in charge of the particular group in the construction industry.
You got married in 1947. Were you still in the army in 1947?
I was. Yes.
And did you find moving around easy in the beginning of your married life? I mean, were you able to did you move around a lot, or were you in the one position?
Well, the fact that I was based in the Curra, the unit I was with was based permanently in the Curra. It was the headquarters of the Cavalry Corps. And I was very much involved on the maintenance end of vehicles, which didn't require you to leave the Curra because the base workshops was there. And apart from manoeuvres, of which we had in 1942, we had big manoeuvres crossing the Blackwater in Fermoy and so on, and subsequent manoeuvres around the country, I was based in the Curra and I lived in an army house.
And I suppose that was convenient in a sense, wasn't it, that you were able
well,
to do that?
Well, the option was, as most of the older officers were living in the locality, but not in army quarters. The advantage of living in army quarters, you were literally on the spot in every sense of the word, including duties. But it took a little bit of adjustment for my beloved wife, who wasn't accustomed to cooking for one thing, and was very interested in golf. And thanks to the fact that a man from the barracks was sent to help out in the household work, who happened to be a cook, was a marvellous breakthrough for my beloved wife, who otherwise would be wondering where the next meal was coming from.
So your speciality, if you could call it that, was mechanical, wasn't it? That you were.
Yeah, my aptitude, if you like, yes.
So you knew the mechanics, the working of, yes, all these, I suppose, the tanks and the trucks at the time. What kind, were they Ford made, or what kind of make were they?
Well, in the case of the armoured cars, the oldest ones were actually handed over by the British in 1922 or whenever.
So they were Crosley Tenders?
They were Rolls-Royce.
Oh, they were, sorry. And they had a Rolls-Royce engine, had they?
What, they were Rolls-Royce in, yes, every sense, every piece, yes, of the machine. They had a Rolls-Royce chassis, which would have been a limousine chassis, with the limousine end, the body taken off, and an armoured body, built by the British Army, not built here. They were handed over. There were 13 of them, and they were on my charge for quite a while, on ledger charge.
And you found no trouble with it? I mean, they obviously were having a Rolls-Royce engine. They were good machines, weren't they?
They don't wear out, but the armament wouldn't have been matching the modern. They were supplemented by home-built armoured cars, built in principally in Carlow by Thompson's, and they were based on American Ford V8 lorry chassis, and each squadron had about 12, 14 of those, and they were armed with the Vickers.
At what stage did the tank come in? What year?
Mid-50s, if I remember correctly. Four Churchill tanks, ironically, landed at the Curra racecourse and driven across the best gallops in Ireland, much to the annoyance of the racing authorities and the local county council.
They didn't appreciate
they had to be transported with a tank transport to the Glenvermoyle for annual shooting practice, and that in itself was not difficult, because to acquire low loader to carry 50 tons, but we had two American, Diamond T was the model, carriers.
Yeah.
And that's how we brought them for practice run.
And so tell me now, at that time, the Irish Army consisted of how many? Four tanks and, did you say?
Well, that's purely the on the cavalry.
Yeah, and on your...
Yes. We had Bren carriers as well, which were tracked personnel. Well, they were tracked personnel carriers of sorts. And we had Dodge armoured cars, which on a similar lines to the Fords, except that they were locally built. And then subsequently, we had Comet tanks. Mm-hmm. They came in as a later stage. And all of the crews had been trained fully with the British Army. So it wasn't a question of just trial and error.
Oh, yeah, you already had people offering advice as to the that came in with them.
No, the crew had been sent to Lulworth in England for training.
Okay.
Including the officers in regard to the command of armoured vehicles.
Yeah. So you were sending troops to England to get the proper training to manoeuvre these.
Principally officers.
Yes.
The driving instruction, a number of non-commissioned officers were sent to learn the driving instruction, and they conveyed it on to the men at home.
The I'm just thinking for a country like ours, how would you classify the military at that stage? Were they, would you say that if there was a genuine outburst, I'm just thinking of the North of Ireland now and the troubles at that later stage, would we be sufficiently strong enough to prevent any major attack coming from the north of Ireland?
My view and the view of the politicians and those who were responsible might necessarily be the same.
What are your view? What is your view? You prefer not to say. Do you think that? Okay, can I put it another way? So, was there a great camaraderie between the troops there? Were they did they everybody get on well with each other? Was the atmosphere generally good?
Absolutely. I mean, after all, they were all volunteers, virtually all volunteers. It was inevitable you'll get, no matter what the smallest or the biggest unit, you'll get people. It was usually, from an amusing point of view, where everyone had a nickname and was usually very appropriate. But as far as the camaraderie and that, it was only when the emergency ceased 1945, that it became so obvious what had occurred in regard to the gelling of people together, and people who had never worn a uniform finding themselves very disciplined force. I have nothing but praise for the people that I met that time. Then it went back to the regular state of full training for officers in the military college, but the size of the army was then drastically reduced.
And did you, of course, a lot of people then would have just fallen off because of and
Need for the numbers, and there was a process of elimination put in then, and there were boards set up to assess who was acceptable to continue. And it better known in our day as the Hunt Board, in which I had to participate as seeking a permanent commission, which in due course I got in 1945.
Was that a very difficult time, though?
It was a tedious time for someone who had left school on the presumption this is the life for all time. It was an abrupt end. And it was a question of how eligible were you for civilian life at the age of what, 25 or something like that.
But it was your intention anyway to stay on yourself,
Absolutely, absolutely, yes.
And the just staying with that then, and the as time went on in the army after the emergency period, was there was there a growing need to at any stage to upgrade the army, get better weaponry, get more efficient?
The answer to that is absolutely yes. It was in progress when I left, remembering that I left after 21 years, which meant I left in 1961. At that stage, they were well on the way to equipping to the highest standards, and with the experience that they had gained in the recent past at that time in the Lebanon and with the United Nations forces abroad. They were always properly equipped going abroad, and that ensured that the training at home prepared us for a lot more than we could ever have done in the past.
What about the missions that are the I'm just thinking, tell me about the Congo and
Well, I
the
can only tell you from viewing, not having been there, that happened in 1960, and it was just around the time when I had applied for my civilian job. I had been listed to go to the Congo in July 1961, which was the year that I left. So my only knowledge of the Congo was meeting the boys who went and came back. And it was an example of where an army which never had been at war, so to speak, were able to take on at the highest standard because of their basic training and leadership.
Was that something that you regret now looking back?
Absolutely,
that you,
yes.
You would have
yes.
liked to have gone?
I would certainly have liked to have gone, and it is one of my great regrets. Had I remained in the army, I had been listed to go in July, if I remember correctly, in 1961.
Yeah. And
it was voluntary, by the way. You volunteered to go.
Yeah.
And then it depended whether you were selected or not.
Did you meet some of the soldiers that went on the first trip and came back?
Yeah, sure.
What were their stories? What did they say? Did they meet with any difficult problems over there, or was it all plain sailing?
Well, it was all very new to them, surely. Problems everywhere, yes. Some mightn't have been involved, but any who were directly involved in Senegal or any of these places, it was total war in the sense that they were fighting an unseen enemy, if you like, from the bush. And they, in turn, were being supported from outside the country.
That's right, yes, and providing them with weaponry. The rest of your life, you know, when you think of leaving all that behind and doing something totally different in driving around the country, selling, you know, in the wearing a totally different cap altogether. But you fell into that. You enjoyed it. You got around the country. You saw a lot in your travels, and you were successful in your job. Or were you?
Oh, sorry. Well, I started as a sales rep, shall we say, covering 26 counties. I quickly realized that the goods I was selling was aimed at a market which didn't exist, really. It was the construction industry was on the decline at the time, and I was out trying to persuade people to buy diggers and cranes, concrete mixers, dumpers, etc. So the quick answer is yes, we did sell in due course. The variety of customers were very funny at times, in as much as you were either trying to sell a dumper to someone in the west of Ireland, and at the same time you saw the potential maybe for a bigger contract coming up with that person, and he could do with a cement silo, whatever about the digger. Now, cement at that time was imported in bags, Portland cement, and there was only one cement factory in the country. Anyone making concrete had to make it with water, cement, and aggregate. So I was given the job of selling cement silos in this country. There were no silos of any make at the time. The name was Porto Silo. And I sold the first one in Mayo to a man very near Knock. And the first question he asked, where do I get the cement? Oh, I said, Limerick. And he was about to cancel the order. The order was worth, I think, 700 pounds or something like that. But I had to explain to him that it would be delivered from Limerick by tanker or whatever. And I won't go into the detail because it became quite funny. And he bought the first silo.
Tell me what happened.
It was the first silo in Ireland, so to speak. And when I thought I had the deal done, 750 was the price, I remember now, because I was sweating it out. I then discovered that he was in partnership with another person. Names not mentioned now, but Paddy and Mick were in partnership. I says, you'll have to see Mick before you get the order. He said, that's all right with me. And when I see Mick? Well, he said, you want to be at the fair in Ballyl tomorrow morning at 4 o'clock. Cut long story short, I was there the following morning. I met Mick. I can't repeat the actual words he used, but he said he was not interested, that he was more concerned with buying cattle or selling, what I can't remember. But in due course, when I explained, then he said, what about the discount? I rang my boss, who was an absolute gentleman, but had been educated in Cambridge. And he said to me over the phone, how about 0.5%, John? So I wasn't very good at sums, and I couldn't figure out how much 0.5% off 750 would be at a glance. So I didn't use the percentage. I gave a round figure, and I got the order. And that was the first cement silo in Ireland. Subsequent to that, put silos into depots such as rail depots in Cork and Sligo, Galway, I think, and concrete batching plants into places in Roadstone here in Dublin. So it developed.
So you brought this new idea into the country. It was never heard of before. How did you manage to, I mean, when you took this on board to try and persuade farmers to change over and use a silo, it must have been...
Well, first of all, no, this man was a builder. He was a farmer, incidentally, but he had a sand pit. So sand and gravel was his business, so that he was supplying aggregate. And in that sense, that he also was making concrete products, miniature concrete products like blocks.
Oh, I see. Yes.
But no, the silo had been marketed and sold in England very extensively, but not in Ireland, ever in Ireland. So it was a British product made in York. And it was a question of selling the idea or marketing it over here.
Yeah, well, and that was your first success. And that led on to better things then, did it?
Well, cranes were far more interesting because cranes per se were non-existent. The nearest to a crane would be what was known as a drag line, which was used on land reclamation. So they were potential customers of mine for machines that were built in Leeds. And the drag line was the forerunner of the crane, in as much as it was on a crawler carriage, much the same as a tank. It had a jib, which was capable of extending quite well, being extended quite a distance, and was capable of throwing a bucket out and withdrawing the muck, so to speak. That was as a drag line. But the potential for that type, that concept, was the crane. And the crawler crane, as it became known, became something, was an absolute requirement, particularly for heavy construction projects and for dockside work, loading and unloading. Mm-hmm. I sold one to Phoenix Harbour in Tralee at a stage when many of those weren't sold around the country, and I think it's still there. The crane was far more exciting as a concept, and the development of crane was such that the more modern crane was a highly sophisticated telescopic boom, hydraulically operated machine. And I had the pleasure of selling the last one I sold before I retired. It was comparatively new at the time. It was a 50-ton mobile hydraulic crane built in America, which cost £1 million, if I remember correctly. So it was quite a jump from a concrete mixer.
Where did you sell that particular crane?
Commissioner of Irish Lights.
Did you? Indeed.
It's in Dunleary.
Yeah. Did you?
Yeah.
So that was a great sale indeed to make.
Yeah, because it wasn't construction, you see. It was,
yeah.
It was a different, it was the Commissioner of Irish Lights.
Yeah. When did you move in here to Temple Oak?
1962, shortly after I left the army.
A different place to what it is today?
Oh, very different. in the sense that this is a cul-de-sac I'm living in. There was no access from here except back up onto the village road. There was no access eastward towards Dunleary. Now there's a wide road connecting the village here right through all the way to Churchtown.
And was Templeogue really the outskirts of Dublin City at the time? I mean, Tallaght wasn't as built up at all.
No, Templeogue was on the way, if you like, to Blessington, Pool of Fuca, where the tram line was running. Tallaght was a village on the road to Cork or Kerry. Via Tallaght, you eventually got onto the main road somewhere on Ratcool. But Tallaght was just a tiny little village with the Dominican monastery.
What was the local community here? Or was there a community where people gathered and met? And
well, very much so, yes. A very close-knit community. Tiny community in comparison to what is there now. But everyone knew everyone else, I reckon. And the village itself, you just had four shops, I think, maybe five. The present church was non-existent. Terenure College was the hub of the whole place. Temple Oak College hadn't yet started. So it was a village 4 miles exactly from the city centre. There's a landmark, a road mileage plaque somewhere outside Terenure College, exactly 4 miles. So it was a main artery towards the southwest, if you like, out towards the west of the Wicklow Mountains.
And to live out here, was it a nice place to be?
Absolutely. Well, the attraction for me was its adjacence to the mountains. Within 10 minutes, you're into the mountains, for 10 minutes, quarter of an hour. And at the same time, relatively close to the city centre, and with schools locally. It was a very useful place to gain access to and from.
And I would imagine that the it you watched it grow over the years. You watched it expand and an influx of people coming in here. Can you describe that to me? Can you describe the type of people that were coming out here to live in Templeogue? Were they non-nationalists? Were they people up from the country? Who were the people coming here?
They were pretty well 90% local, the national, taking up their jobs in Dublin, so to speak, or moving out from closer to the city to the suburbs, of which this was a very, and is very attractive suburb. The extent to which it's grown is just unbelievable. In any direction you look, with the exception of facing towards back to Terenure, where all that area was already in existence. But people by and large, quite a number of my own former colleagues living locally, civil servants, and business people who saw fit to live near to the suburbs.
Mm-hmm. In fact, it
took many mistresses.
Can I mention two people that I've already recorded that were in the Irish Army and would be probably contemporaries of yours? Did you know from Killorglan, a Jack Welch?
Yeah, he had a nickname in the army.
What was his nickname?
He was in the same unit with me.
Was he?
He was.
And what was his name?
Johnny the Buck, he was known as.
Johnny the Buck.
There was a von Buck in the German army, and they reckon he was the nearest thing to von Buck.
Can you, with the barrel moustache. How would you describe him? Was he in the capacity that he was in?
He was the ideal army man, absolutely, cut out for the army. He was probably that little bit older, as a result of which he wouldn't have been eligible to stay on, but otherwise, absolutely an exceptionally, a typical army officer, if you like, both in appearance and in attitudes generally.
And took his job very seriously.
Right, yes, yeah.
Yeah. The second man that I spoke to was from North Tipperary, and his name was Gill, Michael
Gill. He died recently.
He did.
From Nina,
that's right.
I didn't know him that well. He was a legal officer.
He was. He was one of the troops that went to fight in the Boer, not the Boer War, in the Congo.
Yes, well, that was subsequent to my time, but I knew him personally. But he was director of the legal service when he retired. He was the senior. He was a colonel when he retired.
That's right.
I did. I know McQueen. He died within the last month or two, I think. I read it in the paper.
How would you describe him in the army?
Well, I can't say that I knew him that well, other than to know him, to chat to him, that. But, quietly efficient, I'd call it.
Yeah.
That's the only way I could, because as a ministry officer, he was involved entirely in legal matters, which meant that within the army you have the military law, which is confined entirely to discipline within the army and so on. And he would be involved in the ensuring that courts martial and the like were properly conducted.
Was there any case of, did you witness any of those cases, those court cases?
I have been a junior member of a court martial board, yep.
Of what kind of cases would come up?
Nothing that would warrant any more than something that was a little more serious than the commanding officer of the unit was permitted to investigate. But it could involve someone, say, desertion would be an example of a very serious offence. Or
what kind of sentence would be handed down?
Well, the sentence generally was a confinement to barracks. Well, I'm sorry, it would be a bit more serious than that. There was local detention. There was detention barracks in the Curragh. And it couldn't. But the majority of cases didn't warrant that. So it could mean loss of pay or confinement to the barracks for a given period.
Your interest over the years in construction and in building, you've recently published something, or have you? No, you have. The construction world, the industry, you've taken huge interest in that, and your involvement with the mechanical side of it again, you know, the cranes and the all the new machinery that's coming in. In your time, when you were selling cranes and you were selling other equipment like that, had you any idea what we were heading towards? Did you see how this machinery would be what you would see in the skyline all over the place in the future?
I don't think anyone, including those involved in the construction industry or the builders and those directly involved, could have visualized what has actually happened. The way I look at it, if you look at the skyline and it's diminishing in regard to the silhouette of cranes now to what it was 2 years ago, say, or 3 years ago. Any 1 year for any company involved, including my competitors and so on, to have visualized the number of cranes that are now on the skyline would be just something out of a dream. You had to follow every prospect there was of selling one crane. And in some cases, importing on the prospect of selling, which was very dicey if you consider it's expensive stock. So I don't think I'd be alone in saying that it has surpassed anyone's expectation, anyone in the construction industry.
What are your memories of hearing about Lieber coming into Killarney? Were you, was that just before your time or today?
Interesting you should ask me. I had the agency for Liebherr hydraulic excavators.
Oh, did you know?
I did. I acquired those at a
Didn't.
later stage and sold quite a number of them.
We,
They
yes,
would
were you successful? You were?
absolutely, the name almost helped. But there was lots of competition. But I did. I sold them particularly to civil engineering contractors, to the Board of Works. And they were all sourced in Biberach in Germany, where I had to travel and learn the mysteries. But I did. And I didn't ever sell one in Killarney, but I knew the people in Killarney as a result of meeting their principals in Germany.
That was an exciting career and an exciting life you had
Well,
indeed.
Liebherr people immediately would say, "We don't need a crane. No, this is not a crane, this is a digger." In competition with a well-known make of digger that has three letters in it.
It's the JCB, yeah, of course.
JCB is a make. A lot of people refer to JCB and think that Diggs is a JCB, but in fact, it's one of a big number, but it is one of the very important ones. But one had to compete with that.
Which wasn't
Yeah, it was a German competing with the British product that time.
Looking back at all those years now, John, your time in the army, you told me that you really enjoy those years, and then moving on to your other job, that was a challenge that you overcame and that
Yes.
you found it very interesting. What are the highlights of your life? What are the moments that you remember now as being outstanding?
Well, it's on a very light side, but it's a true story that I met my beloved wife on a blind date. And it was at a time when I didn't even really know what a blind date was until this young lady that I was chatting up said, "Look, seeing that you're so interested in this photograph, I'll call your bluff. I'm meeting this young lady outside the Metropole next Saturday, 3 o'clock. You go along and see how you do." And we never looked back.
That's fantastic. Where did you meet Ina?
On this blind date outside the Metropole at 3 o'clock in 1945.
In
In
nine.
August 1945.
Yeah. My
Completely
goodness.
blind date. I had to introduce myself, having already spoken and called a couple of girls Ina, when in fact they weren't Ina and they pushed me away.
John Chadwick, thank you very much. Thank you.
That's a true story.